This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Welcome back to Happy Hour. And, no beer. This is the third and final lecture of our series here, A Flash of Eternity. And I've called this Cultivating Joy to keep myself from just explaining joy and happiness. And leaving us instead like little kids staring into a candy shop through the window with no money, salivating, and not eating anything. Hopefully this leads to some joyful eating. My son Adam, I wish he could have shared this with us, but he pointed out this Calvin and Hobbes to me the other day, and it was just perfect for my lecture. And in this, Calvin's sitting behind a box, and on the box, he's written these words, happiness, 10 cents. And Hobbes comes up, and he's like, oh, what do you give people for their 10 cents? And Calvin says, a water balloon, right in the kisser. And so Hobbes, so you take their money, then soak them with a water balloon. Calvin's like, right. And then he says, whose happiness are we talking about? And Calvin's like, who went to all this trouble? Oh, Calvin. Whose happiness are we talking about? I think that's a relevant question. All right, we're going to switch gears from that to, I'm not sure where you grew up or what you've lived through, but imagine you grew up in Europe and you lived through the Second World War and you had emerged as a 10-year-old boy. And you're looking at these grown-ups and you're looking at all that they've lost. They've lost their jobs, their homes, loved ones, and just simple happiness. And then you notice these other grown-ups, a lot fewer grown-ups, who somehow still found joy and contentment in amidst all these terrible circumstances. And you start to wonder, what's up with these happy people? How did they get there? What's going on with them? It maybe puts you on a quest, as it did for a young Hungarian boy named Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. It took me a long time to get that name down. Who eventually moved to America and became a very famous psychologist and best-selling author. One of the founders of positive psychology that we heard a bit about from Ben on Friday night. That focuses less on, as he mentioned, on the psychological problems and more on positive things like what makes life worth living. What is eudaimonia? If you were here for my lecture a week ago, what is human flourishing? What is happiness for Homo sapiens? What's the good life? A good quest to be on, and it's a quest he's stayed on since his childhood, really. So researching for decades with teams of researchers, interviewing thousands of people across the globe from all walks of life and beliefs, figuring out what makes life worth living for people. What's the good life? With a special focus, though, on what he calls flow. So this intense enjoyment people receive as they skillfully engage a particular challenge. And it produces this flow, or what he calls optimal experience. That's what he's after. And his main findings written for a popular audience are in this book, I think first written in 1990, was when it was published first, called Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience. Now, before I just summarize his discoveries, let me mention the study that this book came out of that Joshua was already referencing, Joy and Human Flourishing. This is this comes out of a study at Yale University in 2014. Huge study. And the main conclusion that Joshua's already talked about is something of a working hypothesis for me, too, a thread throughout my lecture as we try and look at how do we cultivate joy as we look at these different sources. And yeah, this was a big deal. The John Templeton Foundation gave $4.2 million towards this study. Miroslav Volf was the main investigator, but his advisory team was N.T. Wright, who we've heard about already, Nicholas Wolterstorff, Jonathan Sachs, and Jürgen Moltmann. And then there was a host of other people who specialized and professors who specialized in theology and philosophy and family life and youth culture and business and music, everything you can think of, psychology. So this was a multidisciplinary study with foundations in scripture and theology and devotion. So not something to take lightly, something to pay attention to, and what they thought was the main conclusion, the consensus. And you can read about this online if you want. You can just type in something like Theology of Joy and the Good Life at Yale, and there's a bunch of things you can read and a bunch of interesting interviews with these people who say a lot of different things, sometimes contrasting things, as you can imagine, on joy and happiness. And I think this book of poetry comes right out of there. So this is something we've been trying to interact with to some degree, what I've tried to interact with as well. So their main conclusion, as we've already heard something about, is that joy or happiness is never just about feeling joy or happiness. Rather, joy is always about feeling joy about something, in something, over something. So you rejoice over something good. You perceive something to be good or true or beautiful, and then you take delight in that particular thing. So the birth of a child, a restored relationship, a beautiful sunset. You see those things, and then you make some kind of emotional connection to them, what we would call joy or happiness. So that, yeah, if we could just take a dopamine pill and that would make us feel chemically happy all the time, that might be easier, that might relieve us from the task of cultivating joy, but that wouldn't be joy, right? Because joy isn't about feeling good apart from anything good. It's a feeling good about making a proper emotional connection to something actually good. So Volf wrote here a semi-little definition of joy. Joy is an emotional attunement between the self and the world, usually some small portion of it, experienced as blessing. This isn't an all or nothing thing. It's just looking at one particular thing. That's how joy can work, and usually does. So therefore, joy, like we've been trying to say, I think, through the whole weekend, is part of a bigger picture. Our tendency is to atomize things in our day and age, and so we have to constantly figure out how it fits into the bigger picture. And for Christians, we want to emphasize, like Ben was doing last night, the grand narrative that it's part of. That's super important for anything, but also with joy. It's part of the good life. It's part of the obedient life. It's connected to that. I'm going to narrow down more on this good life aspect as they define it. So in the study, they called the good life a life that, one, goes well, as we heard, and two, that is lived well, and then three, that we feel joy about when those two things are happening, if that makes sense. That's the project's full-blown hypothesis. I'd love for you to think about, consider, see where maybe this makes sense, see maybe where it's lacking and needs to be tweaked or expanded. But the good life is is when things are going well circumstantially, when they are as they should be, and two, when someone is living or being led as they should be, and then when we have joy about that, we take joy in that. We rejoice. And joy here then, you can see it's, I think of it similar, thinking back to our discussion even about grace, it makes me think of what Schaeffer called faith, an active passivity. To give you both of those senses, I think joy is the same thing. Joy is something we do, we're commanded to do, take joy, rejoice in the Lord, and all that He's about, all that He's done. But also joy is something that comes upon us, is given to us. And that's the bigger reality. And the whole reality of it is that it's a gift that comes upon us. And so that's why I love the crown imagery too. It's this crown God puts on our head. And He's putting it on our head for the good life. Not to be separated from that. So, there is a time to weep. When things and people are not as they should be. But there is a time for joy when they are as they should be. And so, yeah, just slipping in a little Ecclesiastes before its turn. It's always time to quote Ecclesiastes in my book. But even that, we were talking about, I think, the other night during the discussion, during the documentary, seeing time as, what time is it, as what's on my watch, versus what is time for? I think we need discernment for that, to know when. When is it time to weep? When is it time for joy? And I think what this means also is that we need eyes to see this kind of thing. Eyes that can discern and also see the good. This is what Miroslav Volf emphasizes a lot. So, for example, I'm sitting at a table with somebody and they slap $500 on the table and they slide it towards me. My emotional response to that $500 is going to depend upon if I interpret that money coming from a friend as an unmerited gift, or someone sliding me a bribe who wants to manipulate me. a joyful emotional response to that $500 depends upon me, not only it being a gift, but me interpreting and seeing it, receiving it as a gift. That makes sense. Which highlights another aspect of joy that Volf highlights. That when we experience joy in a particular good thing or activity, that we sense it as a gift. That's something of the delight of joy. The giftedness of the thing. Something we weren't expecting or don't feel we deserve. That's something of it. That's what makes it so delightful. So it's not something you would feel like when, oh yeah, I got the paycheck that I worked for and deserve. It's more like the bonus. You weren't expecting, you didn't work for it, you don't deserve. That's the nature, that's how joy feels about a good, isn't it? That giftedness. So yeah, joy needs eyes to see this good and the giftedness of it. Joy also needs a mouth to take it all in. To take it in and savor it, so to speak. So again, I'm slipping in a little Ecclesiastes again. Ecclesiastes sees joy as an act of seeing and eating, in fact. A lot of times, this language of seeing and eating is replaced with enjoyment or finding joy in the translations, but the actual words are seeing joy, seeing the good, and eating the good. That's how the book puts it. So yeah, joy sees, and joy takes it all in. Not to consume, but to savor and swallow. Like Lectio Divina, when we pray in the mornings, learning how to savor. When things are going well, when my life is being lived well, or someone else's life is being lived well. So yeah, a good meal. It's not just meant to be seen, but you gotta eat it. In an interview with Volf, he points out that this hypothesis they're putting forward corresponds quite closely to Paul's description of the kingdom in Romans 14. One of these famous passages, it's one of my favorite passages in the scriptures, Romans 14:17, where Paul says, "The kingdom of God is righteousness, peace, and joy in the Holy Spirit. So righteousness being the Scripture's way of talking about when a life is being lived well, especially morally, according to God's way and commands, which is essentially about right relatedness, being rightly related to God and to each other, to the world, and to ourselves. Which leads into shalom, or what gets translated as peace, what we've already been talking about. When things are as the way they should be, when things are in right relationships with each other, when things are healed and made whole and good, that's shalom. Which there's something of that externally. There's an external shalom, and then there's an internal shalom that moves into the emotional side too. And that leads, of course, to joy. The right emotional response to righteousness and peace in the world. And especially to God, from whom all these kingdom treasures come to us in the Spirit of Jesus, really. We don't have to wait for total goodness or perfection to come to start doing this, or we never will, at least not till the next age, but rather any degree of goodness or beauty or truth that we see in our life or in another's life is a reason for joy, a reason to practice cultivating joy, joy in those things. So what happens when we take this hypothesis and compare it to, interact it with what we're going to find with Mihai, Csikszentmihalyi, with the assembler in Ecclesiastes, and with the life and teaching of Jesus? That's where we're going. First, my attempt at just some brief distinctions between happiness and joy. What I think I've heard from my colleagues and my own reading is that when it comes to feeling good about something or having pleasure or delight in something, about something, there are degrees. I think that's obvious. So on the fleeting, less intense, less meaningful end, people tend to use the word happiness, as we've heard. Even the dictionary definitions kind of do that. And on the more lasting, intense, more meaningful end, people tend to use the word joy, especially Christians, maybe only Christians sometimes. And usually outside the church, people are just talking about happiness. They're not talking about joy. And then what we've heard from the Scriptures, there's no way of doing this. The Hebrew and the Greek don't have these kinds of words that describe different degrees, greater or lesser meaningful experiences of pleasure or joy. So just so you know where I'm coming from, I'm using the words kind of interchangeably. I think they're pretty synonymous in the Scriptures and in life. And there are some degrees of difference, but sometimes we make too much a difference of those degrees. And my sense is that what happened is Christians wanted to have some way of saying, well, when Jesus came, he did something new with happiness. He did something new with joy. And so what are we going to do? Well, let's take joy to talk about that, and happiness to talk about before what Jesus did with joy and happiness. Maybe that's a PhD thesis somewhere, but that's my sense. Because I do think Jesus did do something new with happiness and joy, and we do need to talk about that and have some way of talking about that. But I think the happiness-joy distinction maybe isn't the most helpful one for people. That's what I've been hearing. Maybe what you've been hearing. Okay, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. From now on, I'm just using his first name. We'll be here forever if I keep using his last name. He doesn't distinguish between happiness and joy or enjoyment. But he does distinguish between a more passive pleasure and something more intensely involved like flow. So here are some of his observations from his research. He says, what I've discovered was that happiness is not something that just happens. It's not the result of good fortune or random chance. It's not something that money can buy or power command. It does not depend on outside events, but rather on how we interpret them. See the vision, how we see something. Happiness, in fact, is a condition that must be prepared for, cultivated, and defended privately by each person. And then he goes on to give a few examples. So it's like what the sailor feels when she's holding a tight course. She's got these challenging waves and she's just using all her skills to make it work. Or it's like what a father feels when he sees his child smile back at him for the first time. You're like, whoo, that's beautiful, you know. Or it's like what an artist feels when she's painted a painting and it's finished and it's just right. And all her skills created just what she wanted to do. That's the kind of feeling he's talking about. But he says it doesn't have to happen in perfect situations either. He says it could be what a prisoner in a concentration camp receives from a singing bird in the forest far away, or what a prisoner feels when they share a crust of bread with another prisoner. And then what he says is, contrary to what we believe, moments like these, the best moments in our lives, are not the passive, receptive, relaxing times, although such experiences can be enjoyable if we've worked hard to attain them. The best moments usually occur when a person's body or mind is stretched to its limits in a voluntary effort to accomplish something difficult and worthwhile. I think there's something there to learn. I think you can also see if joy is an act of passivity, he's definitely on the active end. He doesn't have much place for the passive reception end. And that's partly because he's secular too, and there's no divine giver, which we'll talk about in a bit. So if we're talking about the intense end and less intense end of this experience of happiness or joy, he's talking about the more intensive things here in flow. The best moments, optimal experience, when you're in the groove, you're in the moment, things are flowing, thus flow. And so he chose the word flow, not because he came up with it, but because this was a very common term, or something like it, is what people described. And on the other end of the scale would be the more passive pleasure you would receive, say, when you're just watching TV. There's not a lot of you required, but you're getting some pleasure out of it. Or like when you'd have a beer, something like that. He says, that's not wrong, that's not bad, that's fine and dandy, but it's not optimal. It's not what makes life worth living. That would be flow. And that's as high as he gets, of course, as a secular man. But this flow would be pretty much, I mentioned this in my boredom lecture, pretty much the opposite of boredom. So when we're bored, we can't concentrate, we feel trapped, we've got nothing to do but watch the clock, right? In contrast, when we're in flow, we are totally focused. We don't feel trapped. We don't want to go anywhere else. We've got something to do. There's a crazy challenge in front of us, and my skills are meeting that challenge just right. And so we're no longer aware of the time. In fact, we've lost all track of time. Right? I think you know that experience, which I'm going to come back to. So, if you were to ask Mihai, you're on a first name basis too, based on your research, based on what you know, how should I cultivate joy in my life? And he would probably say something like, well, for one, don't wait around for it to happen. It's not just going to happen to you. Rather, find a challenge, any challenge. It doesn't matter so much. It could be a sport, it could be cooking, it could be writing poetry, learning to play an instrument, it could be trying to solve a philosophical or scientific problem, it could be a project at home, it could be a challenging relationship. Find the challenge and then get to work. Work on some skills to meet that challenge and try to deal with the chaos in that challenge to bring out some kind of order, goodness, or beauty. And then he would say, well, but just be careful. Don't take too much on. That's above your skills, or you're going to feel anxious and overwhelmed. Don't take on too little. or you're going to be bored and apathetic. So you got to meet the challenge with your skills. And when you do, flow is possible. It's not automatic. There's other things involved, but that's the magic space you want to look for. And as the challenge increases and as your skills increase, so can flow, and on you go. But he would also say this can take a long time. So for most people, their best moments in life come after years of practicing a particular skill or craft or something. I can remember something like this for myself when I was a firefighter for 5 years. That's typically a time when you really get to know your job. And I'd fought in some fires before, and I'd had a lot of training, and then there was this big, big fire. I could see it from miles away, black smoke. And my thought on the way there was, I wonder who's going to go in first for that one. It looks pretty terrifying. Well, it was me. I was first in with the nozzle, and things were just flowing. It was like all my skills and experiences were just coming together in this moment-by-moment thing. I mean, I wasn't aware of the moments. It just felt like it was all flowing. And it felt, yes, all my skills were involved, but something more was going on there too. Felt like grace, personally. And I wonder if that would be a better word for a lot of this, for Mihai's research. All right, I forgot where I was here. I wasn't going to throw that in there, but... So, I think what this does for me too is this gives me confidence in the truth of Genesis 1 and 2. And this is why. Where it says God made us in His image and gave us dominion over the earth. What Ben was talking about last night some. To care and cultivate it, cultivate, garden it, to fill it with human life and culture, to reflect our Creator who made a cosmos out of the chaos in human ways. That's what we're supposed to be doing. So there's tons to say about what dominion is, proper dominion, and what it isn't. But at the very least, it would seem that it would require a skillful engagement with some challenging situations in the created order. And therefore, it would make sense that if and when we do that, we're crowned with joy. This is what I was made to do. I was meant to have dominion on the earth. And when I read the different accounts of flow in his book, these people are just practicing dominion in their different ways and experiencing joy for it, getting crowned with joy. I think it's good for Mihai. His research also addresses our expectations at this point in time, which are typically online expectations for life. This is new things we're dealing with. So that we approach things like joy or happiness or like most things with these expectations where I should get a whole lot after putting in very little to nothing, any effort, while being extremely just passive and impatient. So, say I'm ordering something from Amazon Prime in my Lazy Boy chair, and man, it took 3 days for that package to come, not two. No, that took so long. I guess I'm the only one who feels that way. So tell me, I'm in a hurry, what buttons do I need to press? How long do I need to wait? How many days or hours until this joy thing comes along and fills me? I think that's something of our thinking. And so we need to be reminded that gifts like joy, these kinds of gifts, they need time to grow. They need to be cultivated. I chose that word very specifically. It's not called a fruit of the Spirit for nothing. Ultimately, it's a gift. Ultimately, God is giving the growth over time as we plant and weed and water, though. That's the way Paul talks about kingdom work. I think that works for all kinds of things. So this requires work and patience, like keeping a beautiful garden. I love that's how that first line in the poem we just read, laughing in this garden. I think that's a very common metaphor, not by accident, for joy. gardens. But yeah, joy is given to those who are practicing good dominion on the earth that we were created to do. It's felt by those who are engaged skillfully, creatively, with the created order, when we're reflecting our Creator, really. So, again, like we've mentioned, I think several people have mentioned, we get joy when we're focused on something other than joy, right? So back to Wolf's hypothesis, true enjoyment is in something worthwhile, some worthwhile activity, some worthwhile thing. So it's the good life is when in some area things are going well. My life is being lived well, like when I'm practicing dominion. When things between me and the world are going well and feeling well. So it doesn't mean things that we're totally apart from any kind of pain or difficulty. We could be feeling pain at the same time. We could be pressed to the limits of our lives. But for a moment at least, I'm focused on one particular area where things are going well. And that typically puts other things out of my mind a little more than they are normally. So all this to say, I think Mihai, with his research team, and Miroslav Volf with his team, would have a lot to agree on in this area. But there's at least one area, I think, where they would disagree, where I disagree with Mihai, where they would not see eye to eye, where I would not see eye to eye. And it's not so much what Mihai observed in his research, but what he failed to see because of his secular assumptions and blinders, I think, to flow. So yeah, Mihai, he is thoroughly secular. He's very dismissive of anything religious. It's like, well, if you need to do something religious to get flow, you know, go ahead. But just know, like, we're moving beyond that. That's religious convictions and beliefs are so pretty much a thing of the past. I mean, I think that's more true in secular academy, not so much in real life. But anyways, that's how he is, especially of the Bible. And it's sad because it seems like his reading of the Bible is very much a popular version, a shallow popular version of the Bible, that parts of which I would want to reject too. But yeah, he describes the universe as this cold, empty place without any magic or meaning, despite the fact that we can experience so much flow in this meaningless universe. I find that very interesting. But in the secular view, joy is not, say in the language of Hebrews, about learning to discern, to train our senses to see what is good, and then taking joy in that, that God-given goodness. But rather, the secular assumption is that cultivating joy is about us as autonomous beings, what we determine to be good, the goodness we project onto a meaningless universe, and then taking joy in that. I don't think that really stands up to how people actually experience joy, even when we looked at that film the other night. But that's typically the secular approach, which, yeah, sounds a lot like eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We're still eating from that tree in different ways. But here, if there's going to be anything magical or meaningful, yeah, it's up to us to make it happen. And this idea. And so Mihai, he's looking at life under the sun, and he's unable to imagine anything beyond the sun. Any divine source or consummation for joy that might shed some light, broaden his vision of joy, in fact. Not take away from what he knows, but it would broaden it. It would complete it, I would think. I would love to meet him for lunch. And that's actually one of my goals. But to have a better account for flow than his secular one. The secular explanation for joy or happiness is really a secular explanation for almost anything. As I'm reading new books now, this is typically what you read, and you've probably come across it too, that happiness must have been the result of a biological accident from our past. Right, do you hear this language that help us to survive somehow? And now that gets passed on to us. Somehow we got these chemicals we stumbled across called dopamine, and those helped people survive, and they passed those on to us. That's the story of joy and happiness. So we should be happy. This, you know, the next thing to go here is, well, you should be happy because it will help you survive. It will help you live longer. That's kind of how it's understood. And if that's your story, that would make sense, I think. And so, but Mihai goes a little further, and these other people, well, with the right techniques, maybe we can do something with this to make life worth living in a meaningless universe. That's kind of where people try to go with this. I would want to say happiness certainly does have a chemical component. That's, I think, an obvious thing. And surely it has survival benefits. I don't think we have to deny that. But we don't have to think that if I affirm those, suddenly I'm trapped into saying, oh yeah, it must have been an accident. Or if I say those things, I have to say, that's all I can say about them. That's all I can say about happiness or joy. That's typically what happens. But how you start to think about something is generally how you continue to think about it. So if joy, happiness, began as an accident without any moral purpose, then that's how we're going to continue to think about it. And then something like, whatever makes you happy, makes total sense. I think that's just a logical following of how it started. They're taking the story seriously. But what happens when you come across what, say, Proverbs 2 calls these wicked people who actually delight in doing wrong, who actually take pleasure in perverseness and evil? What happened? How do you respond to that? And actually, Mihai mentions this Nazi who had exactly that. He found what he thought was described like flow in developing systematic ways to make Jewish people suffer and die. That's wicked. That's perverse. We feel that. But when you got your secular assumptions, you have nothing to offer. Suddenly you're going to try and paste on morality at that point. You got nothing. That's when you need to reconsider your starting point, I think. That's when you need to think, wait, this isn't making sense. This isn't the best account of what I see, what I experience in the world. So that's when we need to think, yeah, it would make sense if we had a personal creator who doesn't delight in wickedness, but he delights in what is good, in doing good. And if we're made in his image, then that's what we should delight in too. And we should feel something's wrong about delighting in wickedness. That would match. That would fit, I would think. And I think what you find is when people give this secular story of joy as an accident without any purpose, at some mysterious point, purpose, morality gets slipped in there somehow. And you don't know when or where, it just pops up suddenly. And suddenly a description, a mere description of what happened, turns into a prescription of how life should be, what's worthwhile. I think someone pointed this out a few lectures back during Ben's discussion, one of his thankfulness lectures, how when you deny a personal creator who started everything, at some point you want to personalize one of the impersonal elements. So suddenly, yeah, I think it was you maybe who were, maybe I'm wrong, but where you, all of a sudden, evolution has intentions and purposes that it's giving us. It intends to keep us alive and happy. Suddenly, people are meaning makers. How did that happen? When did that happen? Even the pursuit of happiness. We're talking about happiness is now the highest goal. It's what we should do. Even if that's wrong and skewed, it shows we just can't get away from the should. Should is moral language. Where did should come from? Why when we want to deny an original purpose and morality, why can't we ever get away from that? And why do we have to slip it in somewhere along the way? Well, maybe because the birds are singing much more than Darwin permits. Isn't that great? I read that in this book during Jürgen Moltmann's chapter. He said that's actually the conclusion of two biologists, Adolf Portmann and Frederick, I have no idea how to say his last name, Weitnik, something like that. But the birds are singing much more than Darwin permits. I think that's true. I think that's how people sense it, more than Mihai permits. Their song is louder than a biological accident. Doesn't joy point us beyond to eternity, to our eternal source? This is what Paul thought in one of his sermons. This is in the book of Acts, chapter 14. He's preaching in what is now Turkey to these people who weren't Jews or Christians. In fact, they thought Paul and Barnabas were Zeus and Hermes. And so he was appalled, and he's trying to correct them and point them away from himself to the Creator. And he says, God has not left himself without witness. Even today, he has not. In that he did good, Paul says, by giving you rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and with joy. For some translations, happiness. So I think someone was mentioning this earlier. We shouldn't assume everybody is only and always miserable before they become a Christian. This has been an approach for many people in their evangelistic techniques. I think Paul would say it's misguided, right? Rather, we should assume God's been giving them joy all along. And maybe instead of saying, look how miserable you are, maybe say, hey, what do you think of that joy? Where does it come from? What does it mean? Where is it pointing you to? I don't think this is something we have to prove to them. God bears witness, and we're maybe just reminding them of a witness that's already been going on in their lives that maybe they've suppressed, maybe is dormant, and we can help awaken as we converse. But according to Paul, food and joy, a good thing, and the ability to enjoy the good thing, are both divine gifts from God that bear witness to him and his goodness. So not proofs, we shouldn't offer that as a proof, but as pointers. This is where Tim Keller is helpful when he makes that distinction. What happens when you pay attention to this? What do you think? Where is this pointing you to? One of the common threads throughout the testimonies related to this of flow is this unique experience of time. We were also talking about this the other night in the documentary discussion. There's a refrain from a poem in the Joy book, and it's from a poem called Meeting Point by the poet Lewis McNeice. And here's the refrain: time was away and somewhere else. Time was away and somewhere else. Isn't that a good description of what happiness feels like, joy feels like? Happiness is, didn't it feel like we were experiencing something greater than time? Something beyond time. What if these experiences were a flash of eternity? Thus the lecture title, which is in my words, it's from Christian Wyman, of course, he's the poet. But that's his suggestion, I think is a good one. Which brings us to the book of Ecclesiastes. And don't worry, every section gets a lot shorter. We've got two more to go, but these will go a lot more quickly. Are you still tracking with me? Anything unclear? We'll have time for discussion.
What's the reference? God has not left himself without a witness. So there's a scriptural reference to that.
Yep, that's Acts chapter 14, verse 17. Mm-hmm. One of the most famous passages of Ecclesiastes, in chapter 3, verse 11, if you want the reference, tells us God puts eternity into the human heart. or that forever thing, as Cormac McCarthy put it in The Sunset Limited. I'm sure there's a lot of different manifestations or experiences of that eternity, understandings of that forever thing God puts in us. But could not one of those manifestations, one of those experiences of eternity be the experience of joy when time is away and somewhere else? Ecclesiastes says more than once that the good things we have and the joy that we have in them are gifts from God. Very much in line with what Paul was saying in his sermon. One of the times this is mentioned, though, in Ecclesiastes is right after the eternity verse. So, we're told, God puts eternity into human hearts, without which no one can discover what God makes from beginning to end. And I know there's nothing better than finding joy and doing good throughout one's life. Indeed, that every person can eat and drink and see the good in all their toil. This is the gift of God. So, he puts eternity in our hearts. He gives us joy around the table and in our work. Are those two totally separate things? Or are they two sides of the same thing? Two ways of talking about the same thing. Couldn't the joy we sometimes experience around the table with friends and family, or the flow we feel when we're creatively engaging a task or a challenge, couldn't that be one beautiful manifestation of the eternity God puts in our hearts? That flash of eternity. I'm not talking about salvation, just a flash from beyond, a pointer to our Creator. And a flash is usually what it is. It doesn't last very long. This is what Mihai discovered in his research, probably what you have discovered in your life, and it's certainly what the assembler discovered in his quest. So the assembler of Ecclesiastes, otherwise known as the preacher or the teacher, the word actually means one who gathers, one who assembles. This person was on a quest, he says, and wanted to know what part joy had in it, in the good life, in fact. So he says he gave his heart to search and survey all that happens under the sky, to see what is good for sons and daughters to do under the sun during the few fleeting days that they live. And we're led to believe he did it with as much wisdom and resources as King Solomon, more than the Templeton Foundation could give. And then as we keep reading, he says, I said, and in the Hebrew it says, I said to my heart, go now, I'm going to test you with joy and show you what is good. And he says he did this until he could see what is good for sons and daughters to do under the sky. So this is heart knowledge he's looking for, the eyes of his heart being enlightened, in Paul's words. So at first he just mentions the more passive pleasures of wine. But then he goes on to list other things he did and made. What you could call maybe flow activities, dominion activities. He made mansions and vineyards, gardens, orchards, royal enclosures. He filled this place with people, servants and singers, and all kinds of animals, with the treasures of kings and kingdoms and untold luxuries. Again, it sounds like dominion language, and in fact a lot of scholars note a lot of echoes of Genesis 1 through 3 throughout Ecclesiastes, if you're paying attention. It's just in different language. So here's someone practicing dominion to the extreme, right? This is what it's meant to be. With the wisdom and resources of a King Solomon, and Mihai language, he is taking on the greatest cultural challenges of his day and meeting them with all of his wisdom and resources. And what happens? Well, if we're with Mihai, we'd be like, of course we know what happens. He's crowned with joy. Well, Mihai doesn't say that. He says that we just experience flow. Maybe in the Miroslav Volf language, he's crowned with joy. He says, his heart rejoiced in all his toil, and all this was his portion. Food language. From all his toil, there he's crowned. But then what happens next? Sad. Then I turned, I to all the works my hands had made, and the toil I had toiled to do, and behold, it was all vapor, and hurting the wind. Nothing remains under the sun. I've made some changes. That's a different translation. I can talk to you about every single word. It's not without reason. I chose those words. But the good life, it's meant to be enjoyed, but joy, along with everything else, is vapor. It will eventually dissipate like the vaporous breath coming out of my mouth right now. Vapor being the original word that typically gets translated as vanity or meaningless, the worst translation that NIV chose. Usually I love the NIV, but not there. That's not the best word. Or mere breath. That's what Robert Alter uses in his translation we heard about earlier. But vapor, this is something like the assembler's version of the curse from Genesis chapter 3. So, even if I've got all the resources of King Solomon or Bill Gates and the talents of a Michelangelo, my work, at best, no matter how good it is merely a sandcastle. One day, the waves are going to take it away into the ocean, given enough time. And one day, I too, along with my joy, will be washed away. So here one moment, and a flash, gone the next. Everything is vapor. This, among other things, should keep us from taking ourselves or our work too seriously. It should also keep us from idolatry, worshiping ourselves or our work. They're vapor. They are not eternal. Only God is in what he does. That's the bigger point of Ecclesiastes. But how should this make us feel? This has been part of a discussion on joy and things that aren't joyful. How does this make the assembler feel and think, all this tragedy? Well, he says this is terrible. This is tragic. He doesn't hold back his words. This is vexing. This is frustrating. It's like chasing the wind or trying, actually the word might be more like herding the wind, trying to shepherd the wind. Imagine trying to do that. How frustrating that is. Isn't that what life can be like sometimes? Understandably, this makes him angry. This brings despair into his heart, he says. He's lamenting this throughout the book. Is that lament foolish or emotional wisdom? Christians are divided on this. I'm taking one side, and a lot of smart, intelligent Christians take another side. I think it's emotional wisdom. This is what he claims. So he says this later in chapter 7, grief is better than laughter. A sad face makes a heart glad. And so the heart of the wise is actually in the house of mourning, and the heart of the fool is in the house of joy. And you're thinking, wait, what are you talking about? This seems pretty contradictory. And he's always putting things together that you wouldn't put together in this book. Because otherwise he's saying, wait, there's nothing better, I thought, than eating and drinking and finding joy in my work and seeing the good. Well, I think it's because sometimes the way to joy is not a straight line. Sometimes it's through the house of mourning. I think that's something of the poem, the first poem we read, where they meet in us, in that wilderness. It reminds me of the movie Inside Out. Who's seen this film? Okay, most people. For those of you who haven't, I'll just recap. It's in the film, there's this 11-year-old girl, and she's moving. They've moved from a beautiful, happy home in the country to this depressing home in the city, and her parents get busy and start neglecting her, and she gets really quite depressed. And throughout the film, we're shown inside her emotional headquarters. where different persons who represent the different emotions, joy, sadness, anger, disgust, and fear, they're all different persons who get a different turn on the mental console. They get to hold it. And that determines how Riley feels, what she does with her life. And the problem is Joy, she's kind of a control freak. She doesn't want sadness to ever get a turn on the console. So she's constantly pushing her away. And in this pushing away, what happens is they eventually both get lost. And get lost from the headquarters. And that transpires to, well, anger getting on the console, and everything is out of control at that point, and Riley runs away from home. And there's this beautiful point in the film where Joy and sadness find their way back, finally, to the headquarters. They become friends, and Riley's on her way back home and comes home, and Joy lets sadness finally take over the console. And she's there, and then the floodgates open, and Riley's crying, and she's telling her parents how sad she's been, and you're crying too, probably, like, I want to do right now, just thinking about it. And then there's this moment when Joy joins sadness, and they both hold it. There's that meeting place in the wilderness, and then this new color comes out. That's beautiful. And then you have tears of joy on the screen and on your face. It's powerful. But I think that's something of, it's a little counterintuitive to us. We always want joy on there, but actually, sometimes we need to let sadness take over for a time. And, you know, I think there's plenty of good things in life, and especially in redemptive life, that we can look at and see that are good and rejoice in. And sometimes it's after a good cry, in fact, that we see more clearly to see them. I've noticed that sometimes I come out of a time of sadness or crying, and suddenly, wow, a meal with friends is that much more beautiful. Meaningful work that I'm involved with is that much more precious and a gift. And you want to just say with the assembler, yes, there's nothing better than eating and drinking and seeing the good in my toil in the world. These are all gifts, and the ability to enjoy them. Gift from God. Thank you, God. I sense that sometimes emerging out of a season of sadness. It makes me want to pray this this prayer that I came across. It's 1,000 years old. And it says this: O God, I thank you for all the joy I have had in life. I think that's a good place to start. I mean, really, just going back to Ben's lectures on thankfulness, that's where we need to start cultivating joy. Let's just start thanking God for the goodness and the joy he's already given us in that goodness. And then ask him for more help. Help me to see the goodness that's already there. Give me eyes to see this, to discern this. Help me to promote the good in the world and in a virtuous life. Help me to promote shalom that I and others can take joy in. That's what we can ask God for. And all this kind of divine vision for the assembler comes under what he would call the fear of God. This is something of what you could call the Old Testament version of true spirituality. So Ecclesiastes is not, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Many people think that's a direct quote out of Ecclesiastes. That's actually Isaiah that's quoting that, and then Paul quotes it in Corinthians. But rather, Ecclesiastes is more like, let us eat and drink and work in the fear of God, for tomorrow we die. That makes all the difference. The fear of God doesn't come just at the end of the book. Pay attention, it's all the way through the book, side by side with the vapor and the enjoyment passages. He's holding all those in tension. It's one of the beautiful things of the book. And the fear he's talking about here that the Old Testament is talking about is a different kind of fear. We hear that and we're like, ooh, fear of God. I'm trying to get away from fear. You want me to get more into it? Well, there's different kinds of fear. Old Testament scholar John Golden Gate mentions how in this great little book, he's done a series for everybody, like N.T. Wright has done for the New Testament. He's done one for the Old Testament. And in the back here, he's got some terms. And he mentions how the Hebrew doesn't have different words for, say, fearing something or someone who's fearsome and terrible, and fear for someone whom you respect and revere. They only have one word. And so he translates the fear of God as the awe of God. And I like to think of it as the art of living in awe of God. That's what the fear of God is. The art of being in awe of who he is, what he does, what he says. And this relates to a hymn I came across by William Faber on the fear of God, actually. And there's a line that goes like this. A special joy is in all love for objects we revere. Thus joy in God will always be proportioned to our fear. I don't think we usually think that way. I think that's true, and I think that's no wonder a book like Ecclesiastes that makes so much about joy makes so much about the fear of God, too. So yeah, one kind of fear is anxiety. I'm just anticipating something terrible coming. Another kind of fear is holy awe. I'm trembling because I'm anticipating something so good about to happen or come. As Psalm 2 puts it, you rejoice with trembling. We would think an oxymoron, but that's the way the Bible talks about it. And this is one of the things, fearing God is always connected with obeying God, the obedient life. And so we're paying attention to the fact that our God is a God who speaks. And he says things about the good life, the way we're supposed to live. And so joy isn't just about whatever makes you happy. Joy isn't about the goodness that he lays out for us. We pay attention to the boundaries and the meaning of joy according to God. So the fear of God pays attention to that in a very serious way. And joy needs hope, I think. Unless you're just going to be an ostrich and put your head in the ground and pretend the suffering isn't there, or just be totally engulfed by it and overwhelmed with it. The hope that God will one day seek out and overcome all that is vapor in our lives. That one day he'll make things right. He'll set things to right. That he'll take the tragic element out of his creation. Right? And turn the vapor of our work and our life and our joy into something lasting and new. And in Ecclesiastes, that hope is expressed in shepherding language at times. So that our divine shepherd will seek out what slips away. That's Ecclesiastes 3:15. So there's John 3:16, the good news in the New Testament. The good news in Ecclesiastes is right there. He seeks out what slips away. That's a different translation than what you typically see. That's the best that I've heard so far on it. But that's a shepherding language. This is what Robert Alter highlights, is that God is coming after the vaporous nature of reality, like a shepherd seeking lost sheep. But the hope of Ecclesiastes is also in judgment. We don't usually think maybe of judgment as a hopeful thing. We usually think of it only and always as condemnation. But the bigger category of judgment, as N.T. Wright keeps pointing out to us, is that it's about God making things right, setting things to right. And so therefore, it can be something we anticipate with joy. God, we need your merciful judgment to make this vaporous world something else. Now, the assembler, he didn't know when or how that was going to happen. The death and resurrection of Jesus hadn't happened yet. So, at that time, there was nothing new under the sun. Everything was still vapor. But he did trust that at some time, God was going to make all things beautiful, as he put in chapter 3. And he didn't know the details of how that was going to happen. We still don't know all the details. But we do know, through Jesus, that our God is the God who raises the dead. You hear that after reading Ecclesiastes. That is a cause for joy. Lots of joy. So the resurrection, yeah, that's something new under the sun. That's why newness is all over the New Testament. Something new has happened under the sun. And so we can entrust now ourselves and our work and our joys to the God who raises the dead. So we don't have to pretend the tragic element isn't there. And we don't have to be overwhelmed with it either. It will still affect us in this age, but doesn't consume us. We're hard pressed, but we're not crushed. We suffer with a different kind of suffering. We grieve not like others grieve. And that brings us finally to Jesus. This is the shortest part. It should be the longest part. But it's the most powerful part, I think. Just another 5 minutes. Are you all tracking with me still? Okay. There's a hymn shared with Christians across some traditions that goes like this. Through the cross, joy has come into the world. Into all the world. Remembering that the cross and resurrection are two sides of the same person. So that through God's crucified, resurrected Son, things like righteousness, joy, and peace have come into the world in new and powerful ways. This is why I think Christians were grasping for joy, happiness distinctions. I don't think it's without a reason they were doing that. So now, the good life, though, is even better than it used to be. So, for example, prior to the resurrection, joy or happiness from God was just a flash of eternity. But now, post-resurrection, there's a new joy from God that is more like an eternal flame, I think, that no one can take away from you, Jesus says. That is a powerful statement after you read something like Ecclesiastes. So, joy from God, happiness from God, flowing to the world through Jesus, before and especially after the resurrection, has been going on. Jesus has been making a lot of people happy. Some people don't even know he's been doing it. And some people don't even think Jesus is a happy or joyful person. There's a song called Jazz Police by Leonard Cohen, and it has this lyric in it. It says, Jesus, taken serious by the many, Jesus, taken joyous by a few. Oh, you feel that indictment? It's a play, of course, on the saying of many are called, few are chosen, spoken by Jesus. An indictment on how many people portray Jesus maybe as a joyless person. And this coming from somebody who's called the Godfather of Gloom. He can see this. He can see something wrong with this in his reading of the New Testament. It seems to contradict what is in the New Testament, I think. It might contradict even the reputation Jesus had that he mentions as being a glutton and a drunkard and a friend of tax collectors and sinners. So here in Matthew, Jesus, he's in Matthew 11, he's speaking to this crowd about John the Baptist. And in the language of Ecclesiastes, he says to them, John came neither eating nor drinking, and they said, he has a demon. The Son of Man, Jesus, came eating and drinking. And they say, here's a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. There's the reputation he had. He's quoting to them. But wisdom is proved by her deeds. So according to Jesus, eating and drinking with friends as he did it is wisdom. That sounds to me an awful lot like the wisdom of Ecclesiastes. It sounds an awful lot like what we try to do around here. Do a lot of eating, not drinking alcohol, but eating with friends around the table. A lot of good and beautiful things happen around the table here. Now, Jesus befriending people of questionable character, that was a new twist to things. People got people talking, especially the forgiveness. He was just dishing out to these people of questionable character. Now, that kind of thing should be done in the temple properly. Here you are, just who do you think you are? Got people talking. And maybe the amount of ministry that Jesus performed around the table maybe got people thinking, yeah, maybe you're taking Ecclesiastes a little too far. Jeez, maybe, isn't that a little gluttonous? You know, all that food. But why did they call him a drunkard? That's my question. I'm pretty sure it wasn't because Jesus was staggering around like a drunk. Why do you think people are drunk, typically? Because they seem to be enjoying themselves a little too much. They're laughing a little more than they should be, you know? So couldn't it be that Jesus was just so joyful and he was just producing such joy, people were like, alcohol must be involved. That's what they did in Acts when the Spirit of Jesus came down upon everybody. They're like, these people sound drunk. Yeah, maybe that's what happens when you have the joy of Jesus permeating you. I wonder, isn't that why children were so comfortable with him? Children don't go up to grumpy, mean people with a frown. They go to the welcoming, happy, joyful people. Or think of Luke 10 when Jesus says, it says Jesus was full of joy from the Spirit. Do we think that was a one-off and the rest of the time Jesus was frowning and grumpy? Or is that just his way? He was full of the Spirit. I'll finish with the passage from John 15. And this is the true vine passage, one of my favorite passages of Scripture. Crucial to cultivating joy with Jesus. And where Jesus describes himself as the true vine and us as the branches. And I can't help but that Keith Green song. Do you know that? Here he says, remember, he is divine and we are the branches. I love that, man. But branches, he says, he promises that will bear much fruit. Fruit that will last, he says. In that passage, if we remain in him, if we remain in his love by keeping his words. And then he says, I've told you this, he said, so that my joy would be in you, in your joy complete. So he wants my joy. There was no one more filled with the Spirit than Jesus. And the Spirit gives the fruit of joy in people's lives. No one, I'm sure, was more full of joy than Jesus. But the nature of joy is you want to share it. You don't want to keep it to yourself, right? That's the nature of true joy. So I say this to you because I want my joy in you. The joy I have in my Father's love and in his words, I want you to have in my love and my words. And I know of no greater challenge, no greater flow than that, right? A flow in the Spirit that is gracious and forgiving, enabling and redeeming, and flows as far as the curse is found, and overcomes all the tragic elements of Ecclesiastes we've encountered. So in him, the sandcastle that washes away now becomes fruit that will last. That flash of eternity that joy is now becomes an eternal flame no one can take away. Right? In our few days under the sun, we're born again into a new and living hope, eternal hope. So from nothing is new, to everything is vapor, to now behold all things new and beautiful. There's this hymn that hails Jesus as the Lord of gladness, purest pleasure, and I agree. We've got a ton of resources to cultivate joy, but none as great as the Lord of gladness. Thank you. That is all I have. And I don't know what's happening next.
I think we could say amen. I don't know how you feel, but I feel like we just witnessed flow, maybe. Is anyone not here this morning? Do you have a copy of the poem? Everybody's got it? So appropriately, in this poem, We are in an orchard. Mm-hmm. And as we've been doing, I'll invite you to share after the poem words that stand out to you, images that are crisp or juicy, maybe I should say, and ideas or feelings in this poem that move you. From Blossoms by Lee Young Lee. From blossoms comes this brown paper bag of peaches we bought from the boy at the bend in the road where we turned toward signs painted peaches. From laden boughs, from hands, from sweet fellowship in the bins, comes nectar at the roadside. Succulent peaches we devour, dusty skin and all, comes the familiar dust of summer, dust we eat. Oh, to take what we love inside, to carry within us an orchard, to eat not only the skin, but the shade, not only the sugar, but the days, to hold the fruit in our hands, adore it, then bite into the round jubilance of peach. There are days we live as if death were nowhere in the background, from joy to joy to joy, from wing to wing, from blossom to blossom, to impossible blossom, to sweet impossible blossom. I wonder what words you like in this poem. Round jubilance.
Sign painted peaches.
Dust of summer. Mm-hmm. Dust we eat.
Like impossible blossom.
Impossible blossom. Mm-hmm.
Carry within us an orchard.
Mm-hmm.
All from the boy.
Yeah, the first of the froms there, huh? From the boy. Mm-hmm.
Kind of like nectar at the roadside.
Mm-hmm. Nectar at the roadside. Are there images in this poem that really are juicy, crisp, sharp images for you? Yeah. You just hear the slurp in the background, right? Yeah. Yeah.
From sweet fellowship in the bins.
Mm-hmm. What moves you in this poem? Or maybe how are you moved? Nowhere in the background, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's been warm for peaches. You can't buy them, you know, because they're usually newly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Makes you think of Georgia. All dusty.
Yeah.
There's something missing. The title is From Blossoms. The blossoms come, they have fragrance, they have pollinated, and they die. There's this long stretch where nothing happens. And this poem talks about all the things that are packed into the peach, but that long stretch of time isn't mentioned. I just wonder why, because it says From Blossoms.
Do you think maybe the days... is that stretch of time?
Something of that. I don't know. I'm not. When I say something missing, I don't mean I'm not trying to criticize. I'm trying to say there's a blank spot in my mind here.
I think that these things take time, as you were saying, like to get to the round jubilance of peach takes time. Yeah.
Well, maybe it's the sun and the shade. Maybe that's what that means.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm admitting something.
Mm-hmm.
That's the title, and it's the first line.
Yeah.
And there's a long stretch before you can suck in the juice, the dust of summer, the bin, the fellowship of the bin, buying it by the roadside. Well, all these other images happen in a quick burst of time after a month of almost silence.
Yeah.
I love the progression of holding the fruit, adoring the fruit, inviting into it. It's almost like a reverential act of worship in itself, like thanking the hands and the trees and the sky and the sun that brought this to you, and taking that feeling of gratitude for everything that went in.
Yeah.
Kind of a liturgy. The whole poem feels like a bit of a backstitch. Like she keeps going back to the thing before cherishing it for moments, and then moving on, and then cherishing it again, and then moving on and cherishing the next. That says dust of summer, dust we eat. Like automatically, my mind went to dust we are, to dust we return.
And yet.
It's okay,
And we
consume, we are dust, and we consume dust, and we bring it to ourselves more of what we are.
And yet it's called From Blossoms, and it ends with a sweet, impossible blossom.
That's the dust of that peach. It's the death of the peach when we do it, but it's still blossoms.
Peaches are one of those things that keeps showing up in these poems too. Thighs, peaches.
And then there's this idea of like the orchard within the person. And it's sort of like, as a child is like a future generation, so it is like an orchard in the pit of a peach. And it is sort of leaving us gaps in time. It's also showing us this, a bit of the time. You see a peach, you also see not just a baby, but a boy. So it's sort of playing with the now. And the potential and the fortune.
I
don't understand what is the impossible blossom.
I don't know if I know either.
I kind of took it as how we sometimes say if something is impossibly good or impossibly sweet. It just felt like this growing, like the repetition there, joy to joy, wing to wing, and blah, blah, blah. It was just like, it's
unbelievable, mm-hmm. all this sweetness, mm-hmm. and all these blossoms.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how I heard it.
Yeah, like this extreme abundance.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It made me think of like the miracle of life, of like somehow this baby is being made, and mm-hmm. this is the blossoms of baby's being. So yeah, it made me think of like,
this is amazing that this happened. And like, this is the seed, and this is the stem, and water, and sun. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, look at this thing growing.
Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if any of you know T.S. Eliot's poem, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. Toward the end of the poem where he's envisioning himself as an old man, like it's this poem of angst, so much angst in the poem. He writes it when he's very young. But in the end, he sees himself as an old man wearing pants that he has to roll up, walking on the beach, and he asks, "Do I dare to eat a peach?" And I've always wondered about that question in that poem. And this is one of those poems that I take that back into Prufrock, and I think like, do I dare to enjoy something, or am I going to feed on my angst and my cynicism and my sort of youthful chaos, you know? But I don't know. Reading this poem made me wonder about an answer to ourselves along the way. Do we dare to eat a peach?
He's asking, do we dare to do anything?
Yeah.
Do we dare to do anything at all?
Yep. Yep.
Please come down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Will I enter into life? Will I face a challenge? Will I dare to put my skills to the test? Yeah. Yeah.
When is this poem written?
This one?
Yeah.
Recent. He's a living poet.
Huh.
So yeah, it's contemporary.
Mm-hmm. I was just suddenly thinking of, I don't know ethnicity of the author, but mm-hmm. I was just thinking of the Japanese connection of young people that die or like suicide pilots with kamikazes mm-hmm. and this connection with blossoms.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're compared to cherry blossoms, like these young, beautiful flowers that are plucked and then die in honor
mm-hmm.
In like the Japanese perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost wonder if that's part of the connection with the boy, like the boy and the blossoms and the joy, like as if death were nowhere, even regardless of the wings of airplanes or regardless of these blossoms that fall, like as if he was trying to banish that connection and restore the life that blossoms bring. I don't know, but that's...
Yeah, I think he's Chinese-American, but I don't know a lot about his story. Yeah, Tom.
There's a Korean soap opera called Boys Before Flowers. Mm-hmm. And flowers in Korea are young gentlemen who have a certain degree of maturity, but they're appealing and all that stuff. But before they reach that stage, they're just boys.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I find it strange. I mean, in American mm-hmm. culture, we wouldn't call a young gentleman a flower.
No. Or a blossom, I suppose. Yes, Ingrid.
Yes. I was thinking a little bit more about that last line where the impossibility of the blossom is emphasized. And wondering if, like, and kind of like what you said about do we dare to do anything, like, just the fact that the blossom exists invites us to defy the, like, the supremacy of death. Because earlier in the stanza, she's talking about there are days we live as if death were no way. Like we know, like in most of life, it's there haunting us. Mm-hmm. You know, like either surfing us or pushing us onward, mm-hmm. like without thought, just in fear. Mm-hmm. And yet, like, when we see something beautiful like this, it almost seems impossible mm-hmm. because it, like, dares us to believe that we can live beyond death, mm-hmm. which is actually the deeper reality. Mm-hmm. That isn't the ultimate reality.
Yeah.
The blossom is kind of like a defiant sign mm-hmm. against,
yeah, yeah, yeah. The resurrection. Yeah. The both sides, you're saying. Yeah. Good. Well, coffee and cookies is there for you. And then we'll come back, I think, in about 20 minutes to have a conversation about Dave's lecture and anything else you want to talk about from this weekend. So, take a break.
Okay, well, let's have a discussion. What would you all like to talk about?
I'd like to nominate an example of maximum flow.
Maximum flow.
Yeah, something I've given in sort of that regard. In 1966, middle of the Beatles' recording career. They made an album, Blue Loud, but many people think it's the greatest. On the back side, there's a group photo, and it's got the best picture I've ever seen of George Harrison. Mm-hmm. First time ever he got as many as 3 songs on an album, and he's standing there, and you see the smile on his face. He's at the top of his game. He's standing near, in the near shadow of Paul McCartney, the inimitable Paul, you know. And you can see on his face, he was just absolutely in the park. Just what the world was joyful.
Yeah.
I've always been impressed by that picture. And over the years, I wondered, wow, what did that feel like? Anyway, so here's the connection I make personally in the Christian realm. I have felt, especially in recent years, at certain church services, when I meet somebody that maybe I haven't seen for a while, but I know they're walking rightly with the Lord.
Yeah.
And they just come over and greet each other and have this inner sense of something, maybe a deep call, something deep or something like that. But and that sense also of, yeah, I'm just kind of with the cool people. But there's something there. It's just a blessing. I don't
know.
Yeah. Anything to marry that. But yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the fellowship of the Spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah. He shares with that, that with us. Real joy. In fellowship, though, yeah, there's something so beautiful. Yeah, and I've sensed that too, meeting so many different Christians. There's just sometimes this immediate connection that's beautiful and precious. And, yep, something to be thankful for. Dick.
Yeah. I'm intrigued with the flow idea. Hearing you right, he seems to be emphasizing sort of a momentary sense that can come on you in a moment. Sort of like Lewis would have a sense of beauty or something and immediately know once he tried to hang on to it, it was that he lost it, was unrecoverable and so forth. How do you tell, what we've been hearing about joy biblically seems more sort of extended over time than this sort of flash. And like the flow, and most of the times I've ever had anything like that has to do with sports, and it's very fast.
Yeah.
And very quick. And just there, it's there and it's gone. How do you correlate that, or is it not always just a flash thing, or is it does Mihai have room for it to be a lot more extended thing? I'm just trying to correlate this with the way we've talked about joy.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think his focus on flow is one extreme, intense experience of it. He's not talking about all variations from the most passive to the most intense. He's mostly focused on this optimal, the most intense moments people have had and talk about. Now, he does say there's some people, he calls them autoletic people, these kind of people who can kind of find flow in everything. and anyone they encounter. They're just constantly looking for the challenge and meeting it with whatever the skills they have, and they seem to be, for the most part, yeah, in flow. Not like 24/7, but certainly more than the rest of us. And so he's kind of put these people forward as like something to aspire to. So, you know, I don't think, yeah, I mean, I think that goes to the highest value he's got is flow in his life. And so whatever you can do to get there, that's kind of what he's left with. But I think a more full picture of joy and happiness should be, hey, we're going to have intense times and we're going to have less intense times. And that's supposed to be life. We're not supposed to always be full on mountaintop experiences, at least not in this age. And so I would think, we should make room for a variety of intensities and speeds of joy in our life, of happiness. But not be so concerned even with how to make that some balanced picture, but of course, just focus on what's good in your life and promoting good in your life and taking joy in that, and don't be so concerned with how to control how much joy I'm feeling or.
Alright, if that's the sort of summum bonum kind of thing, highest good, to not want to be pursuing it all the time.
Yeah.
And that being presumably one of the worst things you could do, too, in terms of being able to live in that. Because if it's that important to him, surely you want to be aiming at it all the time.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because he mentions that in like a paragraph. He mentions how, yeah, there is a problem here that it could be very addictive and your life might get consumed in this. Yeah. So we shouldn't do that. And he just moves on. he has nothing to offer. Because, I mean, I kind of take that as his version of idolatry, of like getting addicted to something would be the bad thing. But he doesn't have much to say as to why it really is bad or... that doesn't say much at all. Where I think we would want to say, well, our life isn't all about flow. That's one good gift. But our Creator is the one we worship and seek. And He has full life for us. That's full of all kinds of stuff, not just flow. Ben, you're...
Quick question, yeah. And I missed the very beginning when you were talking about flow. But is it something that Mihai... last name. believes is available to anybody, or is it something that he believes is sort of for the exceptional people? I mean, the way I've heard it described, it's very this is people with a particular exceptional skill that are in the zone where their skill is meeting a challenge. You think of. You know, very accomplished artists, or pianists, or whatever it is, some kind of exceptional gifting. But as he's saying, this is something that all of us can strive for to different degrees, different ways. Is it democratizing it, or is it kind of like?
Yeah, he very much democratizes it. I mean, at first his studies started with artists, with creative people, and he was really interested in them and. What made for a creative person, I mean, well, yeah, one of his other books is called Creativity, and it's all about that. But then it broadened. And then he was like, you know what, I'm not just going to focus on artists. I want to figure out how this works with everybody. And so, yeah, like one of the main guys he puts out as one of these autoletic examples is a guy who works in a warehouse and who finds joy in making a game out of his very monotonous job, and how when he comes home, he's always got things he's giving himself to, and everybody testifies to how happy and positive this guy is, no matter what situations he's thrown into. And so he kind of puts him forward as, like, see, this is what all of us could become more like. I think he does mention that, you know, some of us are just a little more predisposed to knowing how to find enjoyment in things, giving yourself to things. But he thinks everybody can practice at it.
everybody can do more of it if they give themselves to it.
Doesn't that sound like Brother Lawrence?
You know the
phrase, yeah, practicing the presence of God.
Yeah,
maybe it could be similar. It's interesting, actually, despite the fact that he dismisses religion, especially Christianity, things to do with the Bible, one of his last examples, and the biggest example he gives in the book, is of a Christian, and who is very explicit in, the joy I get is from following Jesus, but I don't do it for the joy. He just gives me this joy. I just want to follow him. And I mean, the example is kind of strange. The guy is like taken kind of a vow of poverty and lives like a homeless person to follow Jesus wherever he is, and I think to be with the poor. It's interesting he did that. I'm glad he did that. That was pretty good in the sense of that. That's not what he wants to affirm, his beliefs, but it was like pages of this guy's testimony. I was like, this is really interesting. Come on, Mihai. Attention to your testimonies. Anyways, someone else is standing here.
I was just curious, how does he empirically measure people's... Does he go into that? Like, because I can... how does he know that someone's analytic or what? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's a good... That's one of my questions, too. There's not some objective in the typical scientific term of how you can measure someone's enjoyment in a particular area. I mean, there are stuff that people can do brain scans with, but even that's not, there's not a 100% correlation between someone's happiness and, say, the dopamine going off in their brain. And so you're mostly left with people's testimonies and what you perceive in them. So there's a ton of interpretation going on. In this, and I think that's an important factor to highlight in all of this. And yeah, so these studies, like what's the happiest nation on the planet? Like, well, how, you know, just because they say they're happy, does that mean they are? It
could be the most self-deceived nation.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we have to take that into account, but. I wouldn't want to just dismiss testimony because it's testimony. That's still an important thing. It's like anxiety. You know, there's nothing you can... You're mostly left with what people say, what they're doing, and what the person listening to them interprets. So that's huge. And so, yeah, I think that's something we're going to wrestle with.
Yeah, this is a certain picture of flow that comes from surfing, like big wave surfing.
Yeah.
I can't name names because I just don't remember them, but back in the 70s, there was certain styles that everybody followed. Now, some guy from Australia who showed up and wins the world championship by radically modern surfing. He disappeared for a decade, comes back to an older gentleman, comes back with the older grandfather, and the young surfers looked at him and said, I wish I could see a wave the way he sees a wave. Mm-hmm. And the writer who had heard him say that said, well, what do you mean? But in one phrase, he said, no weird influences. And the metaphor is the wave comes, the wave is light coming at you. It presents something. Are you going to enter that wave with all sorts of preconceived notions and books that you just read and apply it to the situation, or are you going to see what the wave offers you and take it? Mm-hmm. It's a flow, it's a living in the now, it's a seeing. Is seeing what is there, what's creatively possible, and not trying to throw style at it that has nothing to do with what's happening.
Yeah. I bet, though, the guy who just saw it had spent...
Oh, yes.
He got to know the waves.
Oh, he disappeared.
So he had a tacit knowledge. It wasn't like
Of practice.
Exactly.
A lot of practice. I mean, he disappeared. He wasn't seeking fame. He won a world championship, disappeared for 2 decades, and just came back, and people saw him and just were in awe of the fact that he could just... It didn't come out of the womb.
Yeah.
But I take that as a personal analogy for when I enter a situation. Am I coming with my own preconceived ideas that I've just read about and I'm excited about and I want to inflict on everybody else? Or
it's kind of like when you learn drawing early on, and then someone says, draw a house, and then you draw a house that's a square and it's got the two lines on the top, because you draw symbolically and you impose that on to what a house. But instead of like, no, look at what you see and draw exactly what's there, that's a different drawing technique.
Touché. Right? I know exactly what you mean.
But that applies, yeah, to every, I mean, it applies to the history of science. The history of science is about letting the created order reveal itself as it is, not imposing upon it theories or thoughts of how it works, but letting it reveal itself, so to speak. Or like coming to know a person, you let the person reveal themselves. You don't assume why they do what they do. It's because how you think they're doing it, but you listen to them. Yeah. I think that applies, yeah, what you're saying applies to so many things.
This is going to be a bit of a convoluted question, I think, but I was wondering if perhaps the transitory nature of this flash of joy is connected to the fact that it's somehow inexplicable. Like, because joy is so hard for us to describe and so hard for us to digest, even, it's hard for us to sit in the face of something that's so transcendent. And so I wonder if part of the reason that it comes in flashes is that it's almost too much for us to bear. Like, the light is too strong, and so we somehow have to dim it or turn away from it or push it aside again, because we can't control that, or we can't put language to it. And perhaps the people that find a greater flow are those have learned to dwell in the light more gently. Like, they've accepted their smallness in a sense, and they, I don't know, allow the relationship to craft them a little bit more, instead of feeling like they have to manage this flash of joy somehow.
Yeah.
That was a thought more than a question.
Yeah, I mean, the way he describes, like, that he has all these characteristics of what has to kind of be in place for someone to be in flow. And, I mean, there is a sense of total immersion and engagement, concentration, focus, but not over-control. And not an egotism, you're not doing it for the money or for how people are going to think about you. Or even on a focus on getting enjoyment. It's about looking at the thing at hand and thinking, this is worth my time. This is worthwhile. I'm going to give myself fully to it and kind of put everything else out of my mind right now. And a lot of what he talks about is actually the mind has a limited amount of knowledge it can think about at one time. I can't remember, it's like 100-something bits of information, he calls it. And that means when you're focused on a particular task, then you're not thinking on your troubles, you know, so they kind of go away for a while, because you can only think about so much at a time. When you're here, you don't think about all that stuff there. And it's interesting, it's like one of the phrases in Ecclesiastes, it's like, well, God gives them joy, and they forget about it, kind of everything else that's going on. It's kind of this gift of like, you know, sometimes I need to just tap out from the tragic and just focus on something good.
Yeah.
Not to just hide from it, but like a Sabbath, kind of, from the oppressive tragedies of the world that can overwhelm us. So 1, 2, 3, 4. Second, I think, yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay, we'll come back. Maybe bed, and then we'll go over here.
Some of this reminds me of this Tolkien short story, Leaf by Niggle. The artist who is always struggling to realize his vision of what he has of this tree, and it's this all-consuming thing, and life gets in the way, the responsibilities get in the way, you know, the sick neighbor gets in the way of his vision, and I'm just wondering whether maybe an aspect of what people experience in flow is this, and the reason why it is a flash, maybe, is this, it's a little glimpse of what work and creative work could be without the toil and the futility of the fall, but we are living in a post-fall world, and so it's only a glimpse of that. And so there's the... I don't know, it's a simple question, whether you think that is an aspect of what's going on. And in Leap by Niggle, he's eventually, after sort of going through this purgatory kind of scenario, arrives in this real land, and there's the tree.
Yeah.
A real tree in front of him, which was exactly the thing that he had been trying to capture all along. And actually, it was sort of the, example of his work not being in vain. This was the thing that he was trying to capture all along. And so there's this aspect of a pre-fallen work, which is apart from toil, apart from the futility, apart from the thorns and the thistles and all this stuff, that would have been just something unlike anything we can quite imagine. But this is maybe flow is a little glimpse into it or something. I don't know whether you think that, whether you buy that or not.
Sounds pretty good. I like it. But I mean, I wonder. It's maybe similar to like when Jesus actually healed somebody. It was like a flow of that, or I mean a foretaste of the coming creation where everybody's healed and made new. I mean, the thing is, even it's still a flash for the person who gets healed because they still got to die like the rest of us, and it didn't make them immortal, his healings. It was just a foretaste, which I think is, the language of the New Testament is whatever we get to experience from beyond, it's a foretaste. Mm-hmm. It's not the full reality. But it's still a forte, so I would tend to go along your lines, And I love that book too. That's such a good book.
Mm-hmm. What was the book?
Leaf by Niggle, by Tolkien.
Leaf by Niggle.
Mm-hmm. Yep. He didn't say too much explicitly ever about what his works meant or symbolized, but that's the one where I think he said, "I was doing the Lord of the Rings, and the war was coming, and I thought." I don't think this is going to finish.
Yeah, it's not hard to read his autobiography.
He's the grumpy artist.
He has this huge grand world that nobody else has ever going to see.
But that story has given hope to, I mean, surely a lot of artists, a lot of creative people, but more than artists, but I think anybody who thinks, I'm giving my life to something, what's God going to do with that work? I mean, that's why I like Ecclesiastes. It's wrestling with the work of my hands. A lot of times it feels like a sandcastle. Mm-hmm. And then that some of that in Jesus can cross over and become a tree or, it's completed on the other side. Mm-hmm. That is hopeful. It's not the only thing of the gospel, one of the beautiful things to me. Mm-hmm. But,
I think it also came out of a kind of writer's block. So not just an external threat to the completion of his grand vision, but his own internal struggle the time when he was not in a state of flow.
Exactly.
And his story got it moving again somehow.
And I wonder, I mean, that's certainly the example of Jesus. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. So there is something about, man, there's a joy ahead of me that I'm working towards, I'm suffering for, but I'm not just suffering to suffer. Not even Jesus did that. He suffered for the joy set before him. And so that's part of our life, surely, in this life. We can't get around that. But one here, and then is there another one around here? Yeah. And then we'll go back there. We remember it. Okay.
So kind of a different thought process for flow. So thinking about modern common happiness, thinking about flow and comparing those to more of the Christian idea of the good life, those two types of joy seem very lonely to me, because flow is about me doing something excellently, and then the modern view is, I don't take into consideration the happiness of others, but I think that Christian joy is inherently communal, and it's linked with gratitude, because in those, even in the poem, Sweet Fellowship in the Bend, remembering all the pieces and all the that are linked with your story and your moments of happiness. Like, even if it's something that you do well, there's communion between you and God in those moments. Mm-hmm. And there's just a gratitude and a communal nature that these other people just don't see.
Yeah. I think that's, you're right. And that's why flow needs the first two commandments, or the greatest commandments, love the Lord your God and love your neighbor are the two most important things you should be after. And so if your pursuit of flow has nothing to do with those two, you're off track. That's not what flow is about or what it's supposed to be about. But he does, you know, in the book, just to be fair to Mihai, one of his later chapters is about flow in relationships. And he really highlights that. And he's not downplaying that. And he upholds that as a very important thing. I mean, I don't think his secular view has any reason to say why relationships would be important or meaningful. And that's where you should certainly direct them. But as Christians, we should say, yeah, it's not, you know, love the flow with all your heart. It's love the Lord your God. And, yeah, love your neighbor. But one and two.
I've always experienced that in the middle of a busy day, or frantic, I get frantic, and you miss the peace. You have to kind of stop. And if you can't stop, because I had 6 kids and I couldn't stop, but you just kind of like find a place in you where you find the Spirit and Jesus, and then no matter what's happening around you, there's a kind of a peace that comes, and then the creativity kind of like, oh, we're going to make a game of this, like this, and everything falls into place. That's a flow.
Yeah. And I think, too, that sometimes, yeah, God wants to draw away with us.
Yeah.
Just the two of us, kind of. But then always to come back and then join the community.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you're a greater blessing because of it.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
But that there's this secret life with God we have, and then there's the public communal life that He intends us to have.
And without the secret life, I mean, from my experience, it just gets all frantic. Mm-hmm. And then there's no sense to anything.
Yeah, exactly.
But then when you find that place and that peace, anything can be flow, whether you're feeding your kids or doing a painting.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I mean, putting forward Mihai, I'm not like saying, just find your flow in whatever you do. But it does highlight how we can interact. I think it's highlighting a gift from God when we're creatively, skillfully engaging His creation, the things around us, the people around us.
Yeah.
The scriptures give us the parameters, the guidance as to what we should actually be giving ourselves to skillfully.
Yeah.
And what's the overall trajectory of our lives, you know? So if we're just these lonely people who, yeah, we're very content on an island all by ourselves, well, that's askew. That's not the Christian vision of a good life. But at the same time, there are times to withdraw from the crowd like Jesus did. And it's like, I'm just going to be with my Father for a while. And
he had to then, find his spot again.
Yeah, yep, and then come back.
Yeah, I think I'm probably just reaffirming what's been said now in the last few comments, but just I like what you said about how like the experience of flow maybe gives you confidence in or maybe you said it then last night, I don't know, but Genesis, like the mandate or the blessing of Genesis, like that creativity, God affirms it, like, and He even like empowers us to embrace it and to experience joy in it. But then also, on the other hand, I think that it can become, like, idolatrous, which I think has already been said, when I start to resent interruptions. Like, but I was in the flow, you know? I finally got my focus, you know?
Let's leave for
Nicole.
Yeah.
And actually, so, yeah, like, oh my, I feel like it can keep coming back to my dad if you've been, but there was a season in my life where, like, my dad was like, well, do you feel like you experienced flow? Like, because I was going to work very late at night to work on some administration projects, but I found myself loving it because I could focus and I wasn't interrupted and everything would become clear and I had very heightened awareness. And it was like I was in the zone. And then I said, yes, I find myself resenting people and like, I want it to be like that all the time. And he was helping me find a more proper place. And he actually mentioned, like, Ingrid, it is good that you have this vision. It is good that you want to be faithful and pursue excellence. But, like, and remember that
the challenge of Jesus is to remain in love in that, because mm-hmm. we're not going to find the perfect fulfillment of that until the new happens in the new earth. And yeah, also, like, enjoy it, because it is a foretaste. And at times he's asked me, like as I've tried to find, like, what would I enjoy that would be meaningful, that I would be skilled at, that I can endure it, and all this stuff, he would ask, did you flow? But, like, yes, it has to be in those parameters, because it can also, I have felt, it is addicting, not that I've experienced it often, but it's wonderful, and it can, I can respond to it with impatience and resentment toward others, because there's also a sense of power in it, I think, which is from dominion, but using that flow to serve, rather than to just, like, almost worship, I think, like, not worship myself, but and it's just really enjoyable, and so we were made to live in dominion, so keep it in its proper place, I guess, which is what everybody has said, but maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that dual, like, it's a gift, it can be a gift, but you don't want to worship it, and then sometimes to overreact, you can despise it and say it's worthless and it doesn't matter, and I don't think that's the Christian response either. Like, we shouldn't say working doesn't matter and these things that you enjoy, they're worthless. Yeah, it's not that. It's just that they're good gifts. You shouldn't worship them,
right.
But you don't have to despise them.
Right.
And those
are,
yeah.
Flexibility.
Yeah.
Being willing to, just adapt and suffer when I need to for the joy that's sent before me.
Yeah.
But then also in that suffering there is a joy that's sent before you, so it does allow flexibility that makes room for love.
Yeah.
Even in productivity.
Yeah. And if we're going to do something, we might as well find a way to do it with joy, I would think.
What?
The joy of the Lord is our strength. I mean, when you have joy, you can accomplish anything, it feels like, you know. Feel invincible, and so yeah, we should understand how that works and how that can be part of loving God and loving our neighbor, and I think this relates to like spiritual gifts too. So where you find typically your most joy and your most ability is where you're gifted, and you should pay attention to that and give yourself to that. Why would you give yourself to something you're miserable in and you're no good at? I mean,
right.
Some people, like we said, some people think, well, that's where God wants me because He wants to keep me humble. And, but, what's that?
Paul said that.
Paul said that about?
About going, being caught up into the third heaven. He said, a thorn in my flesh was given to God to me.
Yeah. So that kind of stuff can.
Because going to heaven would be, you know, something that you could get.
You need a thorn for that kind of stuff, yeah. But he was called from birth to preach the gospel, and that's. I'm sure he found a lot of joy in telling people about Jesus and discipling them. I bet you that was one of his greatest joys. You had your question, and then...
Yeah, my question relates... I'm not going to mention the word flow.
That's okay.
I'm still unsure what flow is. Anyway, I'll find out. But I'm thinking about changing... positive psychology and the influence they put on your perspective of things and how you view things. And I saw a sign the other day that says if you change the way you look at things, to change the way you look at things is to change the things themselves. And as a Christian, I reacted against that because I grew up in Dr. Schaefer's Switzerland, where they were always talking about the world is really there, it's not an illusion, you know, just, I don't know, maybe I'm just caught up in that. Do you believe that? That if you change the way you look at things, you change the things yourself? I mean,
no, that's definitely the opposite of what I was trying to say today. But
right.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's well, again, if you're, the narrative we're in is the, we live in a meaningless universe, and we impose the meaning onto it. So that's how we change it, and that's what I would want to challenge. Is the universe really that meaningless? I don't think that's how you totally experience it. Yeah. I mean, I think we also need training to see the world the way it is from God's perspective as he declares it and reveals it to us. There's some training in that. But I think a lot of times we find what God affirms in the scriptures is actually how we experience the world. It's not, he's not asking us to look and experience the world differently or so differently than what we already are. I think there's enough of a correspondence for us to be confident. This is the word of God. He is revealing the world as it is, as I've lived in it and experienced it, and not as some other imagined thing. And that, I find the secular account not matching what how I experience the world, but even how secular people experience and talk about the world. It doesn't match to me as well. Obviously, I'm a Christian working here, but... did somebody else have a hand up over here?
I'd like to pick up on something Ben said last night. He was speaking about meaning,
yeah,
part of short, long-term joy. That reminded me of Gospel of John, chapter 1. Twice the phrase "grace and truth" appear.
Mm-hmm.
One time it's the glory of Jesus was the glory of God, full of grace and truth.
Aye.
The law was given through Moses. Grace and truth were realized through Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
To me, grace speaks of love, truth speaks of meaning. So I look at those as two very substantive things that human beings absolutely need. And so I ask myself, I mean, the scripture just says, Jesus showed them, in Hebrews, the radiance of God's glory, the exact representation of nature, but showed forth grace and truth in glory. And he helps us realize that. So, you know, that, just throw that out there. I think that's a pretty strong foundation for meaning that both of those lead to joy.
The truth and the grace of revealed in Jesus.
Correct.
I'd say amen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those are concepts, but I mean, that's something you have to, you know, make. Someone may concrete specific in your own life, but that's where I think I can draw meaning and draw truth, draw grace, without, you know, I'm throwing more vegetables into the stew.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jesus declaring or being described as the truth, that's a full, deep, broad term. It certainly, it's about meaning, but it's about meaning that's the way it should be. Like, this is the truth of who God is. I mean, he's the truth, yeah, of the Father, who the Father is, but he's also the truth as the Son of Man of what humans should be like, too. So he's the revelation of the Father and of true humanity in the same person. And that's huge. Yeah, so it's not truth in the sense, like what we would think of enlightenment truth, just purely rational, although it includes the rational. It's also the truth of the way to live, you know, eternal life as God lives.
Well, give me hope my life can be based upon something that has truth rather than vanity.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's what we were talking about Wednesday a bit on, say, a lot of these psychological accounts of joy, the discussion of truth is, it's not on the table. It's not, we're not trying to talk about what's true about the world and ultimate reality. It's more about, hey, look, here are some techniques to help you feel more happy. And so we know that if you think about meaning, you pursue meaning, that's happy. What actually meaning is, and what's true meaning or not, that's, we're not going to talk about that. But I want to talk about that. I don't want to just base my life on something that's not true, even if it feels great. Anyways, Ben, or yeah, Marty,
sorry,
Dan.
I was going to comment on just the whole topic of the whole reality of religious and moral relativism. I think I just wonder what's the obstacle that many of these people are bumping up against that keeps them from addressing the substance of the meaning, not just the idea that there's meaning, but come up with your own. Mm-hmm. But like what the meaning actually is matters. Right, and but I think that's just the assumption that the relativistic assumption that's a matter of personal preference, and nobody can
suggest what meanings to be for anyone else without being supremely arrogant. And so that sort of underlying doctrine, I think, that keeps people from going that next step and saying, actually, you know, it's not good enough for there just to be make your own meaning. It actually matters whether that corresponds to reality outside your head. But that violates this nice, comfy Western kind of assumption that, it's all the same, it's all different ways.
Yeah, it's just interesting how that works differently in different realms. Like, if you talk like that in scientific terms, I mean, you couldn't do any science. You wouldn't get a job anywhere.
Right.
But suddenly, yeah, when it comes to meaning, we can do something really funky like that. And Marty, then...
Yeah, I was interested in the text you mentioned showing Jesus as being joyful. Because the verse that kept coming to my head was, he was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And of course, I guess what was helpful is just that, and I think of the tomb of Lazarus and weeping, not just with grief, but with anger at death. And then it's just a reminder that he was fully human in a broken world and experienced all the kinds of emotions that we do. But without sin. So there was joy for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross. For the joy of knowing us, the joy of buying our salvation, motivated him to the cross. But he was also a man of sorrow and acquainted with grief. And I don't know, it's just to think about what it means that this man who was God actually expressed in perfect form without sin, the whole range of human emotions that we, and appropriately.
Yeah.
And the blessed are those who mourn, as Joshua has mentioned, that's God's response to the brokenness of mourning.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. A sad face makes a heart glad, too. I mean, when do we ever just experience one emotion, too? I don't know if that was... Is that something Schaefer said? We're always experiencing...
This is Schaefer used to say that. Whenever we almost have the luxury to experience one emotion at a time.
Yeah.
We're celebrating our 50th wedding anniversary today. But we were also... This wonderful man in our church just died completely unexpectedly. Just a few days ago, and his funeral is coming up, and we will see his family in church tomorrow if they're there. And you very rarely get to experience one emotion at a time.
But in a world that's both broken and beautiful and good, that's appropriate. I mean, it's how we should feel. And I think that's so helpful for people, like when they're actually feeling sad, and you're like, it's okay, you should feel sad. Things are hard right there. That's a hard thing. Because then it goes against the meaningless thing. Because they're like, oh, the world's mean, there's no meaning out there. I'm sad, it's my fault because I'm putting that sad meaning on the world. And then when you come in and say, no, that's actually sad, you can cry, that's a good thing. It's like, oh, you really? Yes! I think that's such a relief. That's somewhere Christians can come in and say, no, there really is wrong. There really is brokenness. And it's okay to be messed up because of it. Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Highlights. Danny, did you...
I was just thinking about, trying to think of some connection points between people who perhaps don't have a sense of meaning. And those of us who do, and where the overlap is. So a lot of the flow that I've experienced is with the music. As an aside, I think making music with people is really interesting nowadays because you all lose a sense of self for a while, which is pretty interesting. Sort of telling. Sort of experiencing it as a spiritual experience. I've heard people who aren't spiritual say that, connectedness almost. And so that's something that I'm kind of mulling over in my head. And
one aspect of it is like its timelessness, like when you're in flow, especially if it's people like making music together or singing together, is that you're not counting the minutes or the time.
Yeah.
That you're doing it. And that's really fascinating. So you're going back to like the Ecclesiastes eternity and everything. Right? It's like there's the capacity to like experience that here.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's something that we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Just kind of posing those as questions to people. What do you think? What do you think this points us to? How about this? Try this on and see, does that fit? I think it fits a lot more than people realize. Wait, ask, and then, yeah.
I was wondering if any of the reading that you've done or that you did included research about those who have like intellectual differences or learning differences. Because as a teacher, I've been thinking, I recently watched a movie about Temple Grandin, who has a diagnosis on the autism spectrum, and studying ADHD. Unlike the neurotypical brains, ADHD brain has the same dopamine release, but fewer dopamine receptors. So there's like a seeking of more dopamine to have more available stuff, you know, like you need to have more dopamine than the neurotypical brain in order to have the same like feelings. And I'm just wondering, like, and actually I've been studying more of ADHD because it's sort of poorly named. It's not like an attention deficit, it's an attention switching mechanism that's hard to switch at the right time. But ADHDers are often able to focus. So an example would be a woman who's reading journal articles about sleep, who stays up 8 hours into the, you know, she stays up before reading peer-reviewed journals about sleep and ADHD and how that's difficult. But, which is sort of a funny example that she gave, but are there any resources that address these topics for the non-neurotypical individuals that you know of?
Like, that you have a neurological that predisposes you to being less joyful, or
I'm just wondering, like, is there literature that sort of addresses?
Yeah, I think there's tons. I mean, but it can point in different directions too. I just read one recently that was mentioning this case of this guy who had extremely low serotonin and dopamine abilities and levels. And they were like, well, this guy's going to be super sad and joyless, and that wasn't the case. He had other problems because of it, but it wasn't, didn't relate to being less joyful and happy than other people. So we can maybe make too much of that. I think those things are definitely involved in our experience of happiness and joy, but not maybe as much as we think. I did think, yeah, at least the documentary you watched, you remember that circle they showed about how people, what influences people's experience of happiness or joy, and that 50% they said was related to genetic variables, and then it was only like 10% for circumstance, and then their hypothesis is the rest, like 40%, was how we intentionally live. But they did say there's like this kind of set parameter for each person on the intent. Yeah, I thought that was interesting. I don't know how true that is. I mean, this is, yeah. But.
I'm curious more about like how people quantify like positive psychology. Like, there's some, and maybe this also comes with having like proximity, familiarity with lots of friends and family who have studied psychology and Christian counseling. So I know the metrics for the different diagnostic tools, but like, what are the diagnostic tools for this positive psychology? Is there like an MMPI or, you know, some of these things
that were... Yeah, I mean, I think that was Danny's question earlier, was how it's mostly related to or revealed by the person who speaks,
okay,
how they appear, and then how the person is interpreting what they say and how they appear. So, and then they gather the evidence and then they present them to us. So, I mean...
It's like a narrative way of collecting data rather
than
something quantitative.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in that movie, though, they showed that they kind of put this monk in the MRI to see, like, how much his dopamine...
Tell him to think about compassion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, one thing in response to that is that some positive psychologists talk about the set point, which is kind of what you were referring to a second ago. Basically, like the status quo level of happiness that each person experiences most of the time. And good experiences or good life circumstances will jolt it up a little bit. Sad, bad experiences will take it down a bit, but eventually it kind of, most people settle into their, like a groove.
Okay.
And I think that there, I've not read a lot about this at all, but I've read a little bit that suggests that there's disagreement as to how changeable that is. Is that just what you're destined to? That's just who you are? And, or is there other things that we can do to actually not just manufacture more nice experiences, but to actually move your set point? And there's a Christian positive psychologist named Robert Emmons, who does a lot of work on gratitude, who suggests that some of the studies he's done, intentionally practicing gratitude is a way of actually, he says, moving your set point, basically moving your average level of positive emotion up. What I have no idea.
Well, Nikita and I talked about this last term on Wednesday about like the process of sort of anxiety being a dark cloud. As you speak true to yourself, light shines in. But the way that process changes your neurological pathways, it's like our thinking affects our physiology ultimately. Mm-hmm. And I thinking like, oh, and, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, what's time to wrap it up?
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, everybody. That was very enjoyable. I'll just add my thanks and.